Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I'm always talking about the microbiome. In fact, between that and epigenetics, I probably don't seem to talk about anything else, but these are two of the greatest game changers, the greatest paradigm shifts in the entire 30 years that I've been a doctor. And so it's important to get the word out and to understand and observe the scientific process as we discover more and we learn how to use these new tools which have been presented to us through discovery and research and new technologies which allowed those very discoveries. It's really analogous to the situation when the microscope was invented and suddenly those evil humors turned out to be little tiny animals in the water causing cholera. Furthermore, when the telescopes were invented and Galileo almost got himself killed by the Inquisition for presenting irrefutable truth that in fact the Earth was not the center of the universe. Epigenetics, the genome, and the CRISPR-Cas9 discovery, that's on the order of the microscope or the telescope. The human genome, amazing, but only at the very beginning, as we're now learning, there are all kinds of adjectives and adverbs and other modifiers that make the genetic code into the complex and amazing thing that it is. And speaking of complex and amazing, OMG, the microbiome, and the fact that there are at least 10 and probably more like 100 times more DNA messages in our gut than in our entire human genome. How does that work? And what kind of crosstalk and communication is taking place? We're barely scratching the surface there. But I'm going to bring it down to, well, let's just say the ground floor. And let's talk about antibiotics. And what do you do when you've had to take antibiotics? How do you rebuild your microbiome? What do we know about dosing and frequency and which antibiotics do the most damage? Now, recent research using something called quantitative PCR, looking at bacterial DNA, has shown that when you take a course of antibiotics, you get about a 90% die-off of volume of bacteria in your intestines. Now, hopefully, you get 90% of the thing you're trying to kill, but that might be in your throat or in your skin. But the good guys in your intestine also take, what we would call in political speak, collateral damage, but it's big collateral damage. One little known fact is that intravenous antibiotics are just as bad, and in some cases even worse, than oral antibiotics. That blood goes round and round, and it gets into the intestines. And as anyone who has ever smelled penicillin on their urine knows, it gets into the urine. Timing is also critical. Use of antibiotics early in life has a worse effect than antibiotics later in adulthood. And when I say worse effects, I'm not talking about just the microbiome. There are actually measurable effects on neurocognitive scores in children who had lots of antibiotics in infancy. This was published in a peer review journal in 2017, written by Slykerman, S-L-Y-K-E-R-M-A-N, and you can look it up in Acta Pediatrica, volume 106. There's also an association with asthma later in life. This was published in 2014 in the British Medical Journal. Antibiotics have also been associated with obesity and weight gain in children as well as adults. That was published in Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease, volume 19, number 4, in 2013. But how does this work? Well, one of the things that can happen with antibiotics is that they cause the release of toxic lipopolysaccharides. These are large molecules from the cell wall of the bacteria. That's one of the targets of many antibiotics, including all of the psyllin drugs. Damage the cell wall and the guts leak out. Well, the damaged fragments of cell wall can leak across the gut wall and inflame the immune system. You can measure an increase in inflammatory cytokines in people after antibiotic treatment. At the moment, therapy is largely empirical. In other words, we make it up as we go along, and then we check to see if we got the results we were after. One good rule of thumb is 1 month of active probiotic treatment for every week that a person was on antibiotics. Those who have been on prolonged continuous antibiotics, say you had a blood infection and had to use antibiotics for a month, you're probably going to need a year of probiotic therapy to get anywhere back to a healthy microbiome. You're also going to need to give probiotics, which are the bacteria, and prebiotics, which are the bacteria chow. More about that in a couple of minutes. The inside of the intestine is covered with a kind of a sugar crust called the glycocalyx. This is like a layer of protection that helps the gut not leak these lipopolysaccharides. And it protects the microvilli, which are your absorptive surfaces, letting the good stuff in and keeping some, if not all, of the bad stuff out. Long-term or multiple courses of antibiotics show on biopsy a decline in the thickness of the glycocalyx and also in the height of the microvilli. And it's long been known that long-term use of antibiotics causes nutritional deficiencies of multiple key vitamins, but especially vitamin B12 and vitamin K. The intestinal wall produces an antibody called IgA, which is a major protection against yeast overgrowth. Your good bacteria, Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium, really need a nice thick loamy soil, a nice thick glycocalyx to put their roots down. Now that's a metaphor, but the thinner the glycocalyx, the more like a rock garden rather than an English cottage garden you're going to have growing in your gut. And you want those cottage garden flowers so that you can get the butterflies and the rest of a complex ecosystem, which is what makes the microbiome so beautiful. So a good gut gardener, after a course of antibiotics, is going to leverage a beneficial microorganism called Saccharomyces boulardii. This is an antibiotic, probiotic yeast, and Saccharomyces boulardii stimulates the production of glycocalyx and of IgA secretion. It does other things as well. It stimulates the enzymes on the brush border, which is the surface of the small intestine. It promotes the production of compounds that actually feed the intestinal microvilli cells, and it's helpful for healing things like ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, and irritable bowel syndrome. It's also able to work against the terrible antibiotic infection that's so difficult to treat and cure, Clostridium difficile. It has been used successfully as a preventative therapy against C. difficile-associated diarrhea. This was published in the Clinical Infectious Disease Journal in 2015, Volume 60. It also inhibits certain bacterial toxins and prevents the formation of others. But Saccharomyces actually colonizes damaged endothelium and gets rid of pathogenic, that is to say, infectious yeast that can do damage, while simultaneously rehabilitating the protection. S. boulardii effectively eats candida for breakfast. According to unpublished studies by a woman named Dr. Skelton, who is an Australian doctor who works with a company called Bioceuticals, so let's be clear, this is a commercial statement on her part, but she has unpublished data that she presented at a conference showing that it takes about 4 weeks of therapy with standard Saccharomyces boulardii strains at 500 milligrams a capsule to achieve reconstitution of the glycocalyx and restoration of normal levels of IgA. That's not bad. But that company, Bioceuticals, has what they claim is a much more powerful version of Saccharomyces, which contains 12 different subspecies, plus 14 strains of other bacteria, that they say can get the job done in a week. Again, no peer-reviewed studies to back that up, but it's an interesting thing to look at, and if you were looking at products, you might want to look at theirs. I typically use products by a company called Claire, K-L-A-I-R-E, and part of my allegiance to them is related to the fact that they produce a really excellent children's probiotic and have some published data to back up the formula. Now, some people can't tolerate probiotics, and there's two reasons for that. In the short term, particularly with Saccharomyces boulardii, when you start taking that particular beneficial yeast, if you have a lot of bad yeast in your system, you're going to kill it, and you're going to have fragments of dead yeast leaking across that damaged bowel wall, and it's going to generate activity in your immune system. Your immune system is going to read those signals as a red alert and put out cytokines, and you're going to feel flu-y, like you're coming down with something, maybe achy as well, possibly some stomach cramps or diarrhea, but it passes very quickly, a day at the most. And it's usually delayed by about 3 days. So 3 days in, you get sick, persevere. Take the stuff for another couple of days before you give up on it. If the symptoms fade, keep taking it. You've just had a die-off reaction, or what's sometimes called in natural medicine circles, a Herxheimer reaction. But there's another group of people, and these are people who generally are chronically ill. They may have been in septic shock and received high-dose antibiotics, or had a hemorrhage requiring a transfusion, and they have a severely damaged intestinal wall and a severely dysregulated nervous system. And in that situation, you really have to start at the bowel wall barrier functioning and give a host of things that in functional medicine we call the 5R protocol. These involve things like zinc and L-glutamine, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin A, and in people who, if they do get their fecal IgA tested, and there is a Quest test for that, so it's commercially available, if that's low, then using bovine colostrum, which is the milk, the pre-milk that happens when a cow first starts to lactate, and just like humans, we produce this yellowish fluid that is chock full of antibodies for the first day or so before the milk comes in. Well, you can harvest that stuff, and it is chock full of bovine IgA, which will work just fine to pinch hit for your own IgA. And so that can be one of the most important therapies for people with really severely damaged guts, or people who are trying to recover from a seemingly endless bout of stomach upset after a long course of antibiotics. A lot of people with yeast overgrowth will take things like oregano oil or Pau d'Arco. And while these are good at killing candida, they are also good at killing S. boulardii. So if you're trying to use beneficial yeast therapy, you don't want to be taking any of the plant microbials. And a lot of times I'll see those mixed in when a person comes in with their supplements. And I basically have to tell them, you're spinning your wheels here. You have to choose what tactic you're going to take in this particular war. And as I said, I'm a gut gardener, so rather than a flamethrower, I'd rather use a ground cover. Now, there's a couple of other things that you can do when you're trying to recover from a course of antibiotics. And one of them is, if it's been a long course, you probably want to avoid gluten, at least for a while, say, while you're trying to do your rehab, maybe a month. Keep the doses down. You don't have to avoid it like the plague, the way someone with celiac disease does, but you can think of gluten as a little bit like sandpaper. You're trying to get a nice finish on the intestine. You don't want to use rough sandpaper and break up the layers that you're putting down. Some of the best foods to eat are stewed apples and root vegetables. When you cook apples, you release more pectin, and that's one of the best prebiotics out there. Inulin, which can be found in jicama, which is widely available in California anyway, is another good source of prebiotics to help those bacteria that you want get established. What are the bad bacteria like? Sugar and cream. So reducing those is also a good idea while you're trying to nurture that healthy ground cover. One of the foods that's currently just got legendary status in my community is bone broth. And indeed, bone broth, because of the way it's made, has higher levels of collagen. Remember when you used to open up a can of ham? I don't know if anybody opens up canned ham. Certainly not in this part of California. But that clear, pinkish, jello-y stuff, that was pure collagen. And that's what you want. You can also just take Knox gelatin, but I don't like where that comes from. In any event, bone broth or other sources of collagen act like, almost spackle to help replace that glycocalyx. And that too, is a prebiotic. It can be digested by the healthy bacteria in the gut. Butyrate, which is in butter. And there, if you're going to be eating foods to help restore the gut, use clarified butter or ghee, which I just saw on the shelf at Trader Joe's in a jar, so no work involved, although there's some lovely YouTube videos about how to make clarified butter, if you want to do it that way. That's certainly cheaper. Butyrate helps speed up healing of the actual intestinal wall. If you don't want to buy expensive probiotics, then forms of yogurt, sauerkraut, and kimchi contain beneficial bacteria and are excellent. Doesn't take that much. If you've got the prebiotics on hand, the dose of sauerkraut is about 2 forkfuls, so call it an eighth of a cup. And even sauerkraut haters can find a way to disguise that in a salad without too much effort. The sauerkraut can't be heated. If you're going to use these vegetables, you can't get them above 80 degrees before you put them in your mouth. So no sauerkraut casserole is going to provide you with the bacteria, although it still contains a lot of healthy prebiotics. And if you like that, it's good for you. So in summary, if you've had antibiotics at all, you want to consider fixing your microflora. I typically have people use Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus, at least 2 different strains of each, and a dose of around 50, that's 50 billion organisms for a couple of weeks. I like the idea that you're going to take the probiotics for at least a month after you finish the antibiotics. And I want to emphasize the safety of these agents. These are not showing up, despite the fact that they are now in wide use. We're not seeing people with sepsis from probiotics. We're not seeing people get diarrhea from probiotics. In fact, I actually use very high doses to turn off diarrhea when the standard over-the-counter medications aren't working. 300 billion organisms, that's about 12 capsules of the ones that I use, which are 25 billion each. You give someone 300 billion every time they have a loose stool, and it works just as well as Imodium does. Not quite sure what the mechanism is, but I'm also not worried about hurting anybody by giving them back the bacteria that should be there in the first place. I still encounter doctors who will say to me with a reasonable amount of skepticism, "Leaky gut, that's not really an established thing, is it?" In a very challenging way. And, well, they're right to ask for data. And so I'm going to share with you some very interesting data, not all that new, published in 2014, showing actual real-time photos of leaky gut and proving that when a person who has a food allergy eats a food they're allergic to, they actually have changes in the physical structure of their bowel, which can be observed with this 1,000 times magnification. The technology is called confocal laser endomicroscopy. And these devices can be placed on a standard endoscope and used to take very high-resolution images. In a study published in Gastroenterology, 2014, volume 147, number 5, Fisher and Ravens and a group of other researchers at multiple centers looked at 36 patients with irritable bowel syndrome and suspected food intolerance. These individuals were actually exposed during their endomicroscopy, and in 22 out of 36, real-time changes were seen within 5 minutes. They included endothelial leaks and visible gaps and widening of the intervillous spaces, which are the main barrier that keeps large allergic fragments from getting across the bowel wall and into that forest of lymph nodes that exist just under the endothelium. They also had a smaller group of patients with Barrett's esophagus, a precancerous condition of the esophagus, who did not have food allergies, who did not show these changes when exposed to allergens. Standard endoscopy would not show these changes. Among patients who were positive on this test, their symptom scores for IBS improved by more than 50% following 4 weeks on diets that excluded the foods to which they had tested sensitive. Now, the sensitivity and specificity and practicality of using endomicroscopy for diagnostic purposes, well, it's clearly not going to be a good test, as there are hundreds of potential food antigens, but it does show proof of concept for the idea that the intestinal wall can change very rapidly and become leaky when exposed to certain compounds. And that proof of concept is valuable when you're trying to convince a skeptical audience of doctors.
This is KSQD, Santa Cruz.
To sound like a subject change, but I want to pull in Alzheimer's disease here for a moment. Researchers all over the world are starting to reframe Alzheimer's as an inflammatory disease, mediated at least partially by diet. In fact, some people call it type 3 diabetes, because Alzheimer's disease is so much more common in diabetics, who are by definition inflamed. A lot of interesting detail here, but let's pull it back to the microbiome. There is data in human subjects that connects the dots. The leaky gut and the microbiome go hand in hand with diet. Here's how it works. When you eat a diet high in saturated fat, sugar, and low in fiber, you cause alterations in your microbiome. And one of those changes is that the bacteria that you've got in there make more endotoxin. The endotoxin damages this fragile barrier functioning, making for a leaky gut, and the endotoxin leaks through across the leaky gut and is able to cross into the brain, where it interferes with the blood-brain barrier, making that leaky as well. Researchers have identified adverse changes in hippocampal function. Hippocampus is where you do your memory, and so when your hippocampus isn't functioning, you start looking like an Alzheimer's patient. So the researchers conclude from their study that Western diet consumption increases production of endotoxins by commensal bacteria, which may promote neuroinflammation and cognitive dysfunction. So what happens if you eat that diet and you're constantly producing endotoxin and you're constantly irritating your immune system? Well, eventually you get systemic inflammation, because those lymph nodes in the intestine produce inflammatory cytokines, the same kind of chemical signals that are released when you have the flu. And this causes upregulation everywhere. So if you have a little bit of arthritis, that might flare. If you have a little bit of sinus congestion, that might flare. And of course, if you have a little bit of brain dysfunction, the inflammation in your brain might impair your functioning on standardized testing, which is exactly what happened in this study by Noble that was published in Frontiers of Behavioral Neuroscience in 2017. There's a study by Dalutatsai in CNS Neurological Disorders and Drug Targets, 2015, that showed that at least in some people, grain-based proteins can trigger immune-mediated gut dysbiosis, affect the gut-brain axis, dysregulate the metabolism, increase measurably in the bloodstream pro-inflammatory cytokines, and have effects on cognitive testing. So what can I offer you in the way of practical recommendations here? Well, limit saturated fat and carbohydrates, processed foods, and sugars. Eat a diet rich in lean proteins. Eat lots of fiber-rich fruits and vegetables. Whole grain foods such as flax seeds, also even the less glycemic grains such as quinoa are perfectly acceptable because they do not have this property of kicking up the endotoxemia. Foods rich in omega-3 fatty acids reduce inflammation in the gut and are thus protective. So along with flax seeds, we have walnuts, avocados, salmon, and other fatty fish. Probiotics themselves are anti-inflammatory. So if you're going to indulge, it might be the time to take an extra probiotic capsule and maybe some vitamin C with your Whopper. And finally, a very bit of practical advice. Don't eat on the run. Chew your food. Pay attention to what you're eating. And don't allow yourself to be distracted, because your digestion is very influenced by the thoughts in your head. If you're thinking stressful thoughts, you're actually going to measurably reduce the amount of stomach acid you produce. That's your first protection against bad bacteria. Also, you'll make less digestive juices when those are necessary. If you're not focused on the food, or if there is a lot of stimulation that puts you into fight or flight mood. So if you have irritable bowel, cut out the coffee, cut out the alcohol, don't eat at your desk, go on a salad a day regimen, and stay away from the crap for a week and see if you still have irritable bowel. We're going to change to a completely different topic now and talk a little bit about cancer. People often worry that removing a cancer might cause it to spread. And there hasn't been a lot of data to back that up, although it's been looked for and not found. The only exception being the recurrence of cancer in the suture line in breast cancer cases, which is a thing. And it often is why in early breast cancers that aren't going to require chemotherapy, a dose of radiation to the scar line is often done preventatively. But sometimes after surgery, we see a flare in what were previously hidden micrometastases in other parts of the body. And this isn't a very well understood phenomenon. So researchers went after it by using mice. And what they found is, well, both disturbing, interesting, and at least actionable. So I want to share the data with you. 273 mice were given fake metastases by having an aggressive mouse breast cancer, tiny bits of cells implanted in various locations. And initially the tumor cells grew, but then they entered into a kind of dormancy, a hibernation phase. This dormancy occurred only in mice with intact immunity, suggesting that the immune system was able to contain and isolate and stop the micrometastases, but not quite able to eliminate them totally. In these mice, surgery of any type, not just resection of a primary tumor, but other types of surgeries, led to aggressive growth of the pseudometastases in about 60% of the animals, compared with 10% of control animals that did not undergo surgery. All surgical procedures cause systemic inflammation. What happened visually was that activated monocytes from the bone marrow left the bone marrow in these mice and migrated to the sites of the pseudometastases and became tumor-associated macrophages. these macrophages actually suppressed the immune system in a halo around the tumor, allowing them to awaken from their enforced dormancy. Now, here's what's useful. Treating the mice with anti-inflammatory drugs like steroids or ibuprofen before the surgery or immediately following the surgery greatly reduced the growth of the micrometastasis. So if you're a patient with any kind of cancer who's looking at an upcoming surgery, you might want to actually bite the bullet and take a little prednisone before the surgery and some ibuprofen afterwards. You probably won't be able to get your doctor on board with this because it's just mouse data. But, you know, honestly, I'd be prepared to act on this just on the won't hurt, might help paradigm. And certainly, a lot of what we do in the immediate post-op period involves pain control. So once the blood's clotted and the wound is sewed up, why not take some anti-inflammatories? Protect your stomach by taking them with food and all of that. But still, if we're talking about the possibility that micrometastases could wake up in anybody, we should be considering this step. That's my opinion. And it's based on an extension of science, not on human studies. So let me qualify it properly. We're going to move into talking about some science news and some things that I'm finding quite interesting. Let's start with this new drug for Alzheimer's disease that made such a splash in the newspapers over the last week or so. The agent is called BAN2401, but don't worry, if it ever becomes commercially available, you can be sure that it will get a nice flashy title like Cognex or something. Anyway, the study was looking at whether or not this drug, which has passed its initial safety testing, actually has an effect on amyloid and trying to figure out the dose. Now, amyloid plaques are the thing that we can see in Alzheimer's brains under a microscope, but we also now have PET scans and other technologies that can look at beta amyloid non-invasively. The study looked at over 800 people in several different countries, and only one of the doses of drug, the highest, achieved statistical significance. In that group, the dose given was around 700 milligrams by injection every 2 weeks. At 12 months, which was last December, there wasn't a deviation between the two groups, but now at the 18-month mark, the group that receives the drug at the highest dose had 81% showing significant drops in the accumulation of amyloid plaque, and in fact, reduction of plaque going backwards, and that is really impressive. We can get rid of the plaque now with drugs. The question is, can we affect cognition? And the data is a little bit tricky on that. Supposedly, they showed the rate of decline in the group that saw such dramatic reduction in their amyloid was 30% slower than the placebo group. Yeah, that's not super impressive. Slowing the rate of decline doesn't really get to the root of the problem. And when I look at the data, to me that says, yeah, the amyloid plaque is not the cause of the decline, or we would have seen a much more dramatic result. The question really also relies on the testing that was done. The companies invented their own cognitive assessment test, calling it the Alzheimer's Disease Composite Score. It draws on elements from three other more established cognitive tests, but it raises the question in my mind of why didn't they use one of the validated measures rather than, well, let's just say cherry-picking the three tests and pulling the questions that they thought their group would do the best on? There have been a couple of earlier drugs that did almost as well in erasing plaque, but yeah, they also killed the patients. Most of them caused serious side effects like brain swelling and bleeding in the brain. But on the upside, fewer than 10% of the 800 people taking the new drug experienced such effects. Still not ready for primetime, folks, with 10% receiving serious brain effects. We're not looking at an agent I'd be willing to give my mother. of course, there are lots of other drugs in the pipeline. And as you might expect, the companies that make them are talking this one up, as well as potentially raising the possibility of maybe we could combine these agents. Yes, right. That's a little blue skying, if you ask me, but both companies did experience substantial increases in their stock this week. So let's just say that putting this out through press release to the New York Times before it's published is, let's just say there might be some secondary gain. I am not excited. On the other hand, I am pretty excited about this research just published coming out of Queen Mary University of London that looked at pancreatic cancer in mice and a naturally occurring constituent of medical cannabis. This was published in the July issue of Oncogene, and you guessed it, it's testing CBD. Researchers using a mouse model of pancreatic cancer gave the mice CBD at a dose that could actually be reasonably consumed by a human and found that the mice with pancreatic cancer survived 3 times longer if CBD was added to their chemotherapy treatment. Given that CBD is already approved for use in clinics, this could jump and leapfrog quite quickly if the human studies prove promising. The 5-year survival for pancreatic cancer patients is less than 7%. So any therapeutic agent that prolongs that has a huge potential for life-saving and improved quality of life. And I love the fact that it grows on trees. Again, mouse study only, so we can't extrapolate to humans yet. But on the other hand, CBD is already approved for treatment of nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, and other chemotherapy side effects. So what the heck? And a second scientific study about cancer, this one looking at pH and cancer cells. Now, you can't go online and type the word alkaline or acidic without finding a host of pages saying, oh, acid, bad, 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 alkaline, good, good, good. If you alkalinize your body with our alkaline water products, you will lower your risk of cancer because the environment around cancer cells is acidic. So therefore, cancers must like acid, and acid must make cancer. And, oh, here's this epidemiologic study showing that people who have high acid in their diet, like lots of red meat, have higher cancer rates. So it must be true that you can reverse that with alkalinization in an alkaline diet. And, oh, God, it's such flawed logic, and this study points out how, in fact, it might be the exact opposite. So, first of all, I want you to think about a teeter-totter. Acid base in the body, in any natural environment, including cancer cells, is kind of like a teeter-totter. If I want to make myself more acidic, then I'm going to push basic materials, that is to say alkalinizing materials, outside of my environment, and I will become more acidic inside my environment, and the environment immediately surrounding me will be filled with acid. And the opposite is also true. So cancer cells actually push hydrogen ions out. They do this through a biological mechanism. As they push the hydrogen ions out, they become more alkaline inside, and the environment around the cancer cell becomes more acidic, which we've known for many years, but which has potentially, at least according to this study, been drastically misinterpreted. It turns out that cancer cells like to be alkaline on the inside. If you surround the cancer cells with an alkaline environment, some of this diffuses into the cells, making them more alkaline and actually increasing their rate of growth. It's a very good thing that alkaline water doesn't work because we have these things called kidneys, and you can't affect your intracellular pH very easily because there are all sorts of adaptive mechanisms that allow the cell itself to dial its optimum internal pH. You would have to poison these mechanisms to be able to make a difference. But there are enzymes that will do that and increase the acidic environment around the cancer cells, which will allow for the diffusion of hydrogen ions back into the cancer cells, if you get the concentration high enough on the outside anyway, you will, which could interfere with the optimum growth conditions for cancer cells. While it might be hard to acidify the intracellular environment via acidifying the extracellular environment, it's not impossible, and it's the exact opposite of what people thought would be beneficial. More work needs to be done in this regard, and I don't really see it as a potential therapeutic target, but I like the irony that what we thought, based on applying logic to an observed fact, turns out to be the exact opposite because the cells themselves push back. And that, my friends, is one of the great truths of medicine. When you shift the thing too far over, the body pushes back. The cell pushes back. It knows where it wants to be. And whatever you do may or may not be successful in the long run because it will compensate for it. It's always dangerous to apply logic to biological systems. And a good example of that is with respect to children's allergies. Now, in a family where there is a high tendency for allergies, where maybe one of the older siblings has had eczema and then has multiple food allergies when they're older, and perhaps asthma, there's been a tendency for pediatricians to suggest that with the next child, you avoid exposure to foods that children are often allergic to, such as cow's milk products, eggs, and peanuts, and perhaps for the first year of life, keep them away from these things. Seems logical, but it turns out not to be true. Actually, children who are exposed to these products during the first year of life are at a lower risk of developing allergies to these foods later on. Something's going on in that first year. You have this large organ called a thymus, and one of the things the thymus does is teach you now how not to have lupus, how not to have autoimmune disease, because it teaches you to recognize what's self and not self, what's friend and what's foe. Well, it also appears to influence exposures to food, because if the thymus decides to recognize eggs and peanuts as friends, then later on, the chances of developing allergies to them when the thymus goes away is less. This is medically counterintuitive, but it's supported by good data coming out of a large Canadian study called the Child Study, which has followed 3,500 Canadian children and their families since before birth. About a year ago, I reported to you how a child study group showed that feeding the mother peanuts during pregnancy, before the baby was born, actually reduced the risk of peanut allergy in the child later on. And this is just an extension of that. A embryo and a fetus are certainly different from a baby, but a newborn and a baby is different from a child, and how their systems function is different enough that what's good for one may not be good for another. In a follow-up study, these researchers looked at predicting who will have asthma by 5 years of age and who will have food allergies at three. Now, there's a lot of children that have eczema in infancy who do not go on to develop these diseases, but knowing who would be at risk would be very helpful in the therapeutics. So what the researchers did was they skin tested one-year-olds using standard skin testing, and the ones who were showing signs of food food sensitivity were tracked. Those that did not have food sensitivity at 1 year were much less likely to have food sensitivity at 3 years and much less likely to have asthma at 5 years. So if we can identify the high-risk children and develop some sort of therapeutic strategy for them, possibly involving graded exposures to antigenic foods coupled with the use of probiotics or other agents like vitamin D that are known to regulate the immune system, we may be able to head off asthma before it develops. And that would be an extraordinarily useful advance in pediatrics.
Listeners to this program may remember in 2015 when I told you about the discovery of the year, which was that we actually have lymph vessels in our brain. This falls into the category of everything we thought we knew was wrong about the brain, in that no one had ever located or found lymph vessels, and this was just received wisdom that they didn't exist. However, they do in fact exist, and the lab belonging to Dr. Kipnis at the University of Virginia showed irrefutable proof of this in 2015. And it's a big deal, but the latest work is even more important. Dr. Kipnis' lab has been looking at mice who are models for Alzheimer's disease. These mice have a mutant version of the amyloid protein that tends to accumulate as amyloid beta in the brain, and they develop problems with memory, which we test in mice by having them run mazes to find food, and other sorts of dastardly scientific interventions designed to torture the poor animals but reveal the secrets of how life and brains work. Part of the work involved blocking these lymph vessels, which exist in the meninges, the covering over the brain. When this happened, the brains of the mice did two very interesting things, one of which is they deteriorated rapidly and the memory became deeply compromised, much faster than control mice. The other is that pathologically, the specimens of the brain developed large plaques looking exactly like those of Alzheimer's disease in humans. Conversely, when the researchers at Kipnis' lab actually gave a compound that increased lymph drainage from the brain, bringing lymph fluid and toxins out of the brain and back into the general circulation where it can be destroyed in the liver, they saw improvement both in the existing plaques, but also very substantial improvement in the cognitive and memory functioning of these mice. Taking out the trash and removing the accumulated garbage in the brain is one of the holy grails of Alzheimer's research. These compounds that improve lymphatic drainage may prove to be invaluable in the future. Imagine your brain as an apartment building, an apartment with a long hallway that connects all of the rooms. Now imagine that hallway starts to accumulate stacks of newspapers and magazines, use tin cans and various other material no longer needed, but you just can't take out the trash. Restoring the lymphatics is like taking a giant fire hose and washing those corridors clean. Maybe soon, we'll have agents that help floss the brain. In the meantime, exercise and staying hydrated are two known ways to improve the function of your lymphatic system, and that probably includes your brain lymphatics as well. In related news, this study just published in the Journal of Neuroscience, 2018, number 0273, is very interesting and relates to how sleep consolidates memory. The research was funded by the U.S. Department of Defense and performed at the University of New Mexico. Researchers sought to enhance the normal consolidation of memory that takes place during slow-wave sleep by enhancing slow-wave sleep using an external electrical stimulation device. It's called closed-loop transcranial alternating current stimulation. We have ways of applying electricity to the surface of the scalp or magnetism to the head, and we can induce wave phenomenon inside the brain. It's a little bit like the concept of resonance. The classic example of that being the high-pitched sopranos singing and the wine glass vibrating until it breaks. You can induce resonance with magnets across the scalp, but you can also do it with this electrical stimulation technique. The timing is critical, and so the timing of the stimulation was exactly that of the slow wave oscillations that are seen during sleep. By putting the slow waves outside the brain, they actually were induced inside the brain. People got deeper sleep faster. And when they were tested in terms of their ability to learn a new task, they scored much higher when they slept using the device in a sleep lab. Now, being that this was sponsored by the Department of Defense, you won't be surprised to learn that the participants were trained and tested on a realistic visual discrimination task in which they had to detect potentially threatening hidden objects and people, such as explosive devices and enemy snipers. Those in the intervention group showed substantially improved performance detecting targets in similar but novel situations the next day compared to the group who did not receive the same stimulation. This implies that memory integration and crosswiring was more effective with the deep sleep stimulating waveforms. Several years ago, I shared with you a story about a helmet, also developed by the military, that improves functioning of the occipital cortex. That's where you see and turned a reporter who reported on the story from a pretty bad shot into an excellent shot when she was wearing the helmet that stimulated that part of the brain. Are we just a heartbeat away from the age of neural augmentation devices? Maybe. Stay tuned, because you know you'll hear about it here on Ask Dr. Dawn. My regular listeners will have heard me talk about vitamin K in passing before, usually in response to patients' questions about osteoporosis. So I thought, let's do a deep dive into this missing vitamin that none of us ever heard of. Vitamin K comes in two forms. Vitamin K1 is found in high concentrations in leafy green vegetables. It's biologically active in humans, and many animal species convert vitamin K1 to vitamin K2 in the intestines with the help of their microbiome. The vitamin K2 compounds are called the menaquinones, and they're the main form of storage for vitamin K in the body. And there are different subtypes that affect the enzymatic function of the molecule. K2 is found naturally in a host of animal-derived foods, such as butter, egg yolks, chicken and goose liver, as well as aged cheeses like Gouda, Brie, and Cheddar. Also, fermented vegetable foods like sauerkraut and natto contain vitamin K2. Vitamin K1 is most associated with coagulation, and in fact, warfarin or Coumadin works by interfering with the action of vitamin K1 and can also be reversed when massive doses are given. Infants often receive a dose of vitamin K1 at birth to help them with blood clotting. Because they do not have a microbiome, they need to receive this exogenously. But what's the bone connection and the calcium connection with vitamin K? Well, that's where vitamin K2 comes in. Both coagulation and bone formation rely on the calcium binding capacity of a special protein called a GLA protein. Vitamin K is a key player in the carboxylation and activation of this G protein complex. In the case of bone, there's a protein on the surface of bone cells called osteocalcin. Osteocalcin is there on the surface of the bone building cells to grab calcium from the bloodstream and surrounding body fluids, but it can only do that after it's been primed by vitamin K2. If you are a postmenopausal woman and you don't eat natto or large volumes of sauerkraut on a regular basis, you probably want to take extra vitamin K2. I recommend the MK7 form, for reasons I'll explain in a moment, and a dose of about 150 to 180 micrograms is the one that's been validated in most studies. In fact, in Japan, a 45 milligram dose of a different subfraction of vitamin K, MK4, is regulated as a pharmaceutical agent for the treatment of osteoporosis. So what about calcium in the arteries? Well, ironically, vitamin K2 has the opposite effect in the arteries. And as you might expect, that effect also hinges on another GLA protein called matrix GLA protein. This protein is found on the inside of blood vessel walls, and it actually inhibits calcium deposits into the vessel wall, therefore reducing hardening of the arteries. Matrix GLA protein inhibits the crystallization of calcium and prevents atherosclerosis. A study done in 2004 in Rotterdam confirmed that in a large cohort, almost 5,000 subjects, those with the highest intake of vitamin K2 had the lowest rate of coronary artery disease and coronary artery calcification. So if you're one of those people out there with a positive coronary calcium scan, you might consider going on a little extra vitamin K. And that's MK7, vitamin K2, probably 150 to 250 micrograms. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.